Today, fighting against the Fed. The DFA Daily to the 18th of March 2021. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In today's episode, we discuss Chairman Jerome Powell's announcements overnight and also look at the impact of JobKeeper, as well as some interesting questions relating to homelessness in Tasmania and the broader impacts on the economy as reflected in the latest unemployment data. So let's get started. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell and his colleagues continue to project near zero interest rates out through 2023, despite upgrading their US economic outlook and the mounting inflation worries in financial markets.
The overall recovery in economic activity since last spring is due, importantly, to unprecedented fiscal and monetary policy actions, which have provided essential support to households, businesses, and communities. The recovery has progressed more quickly than generally expected, and forecasts from FOMC participants for economic growth this year have been revised up notably since our December summary of economic projections.
In fact, markets behaved quite well, but the 10-year was also higher, and that perhaps is not what they would want to see. The decision, which came on a volatile day for investors, with the Treasury yield surging ahead of the announcement, masked a growing number of officials who saw liftoff before then, although Powell stressed this remains a minority view. The strong bulk of the committee is not showing a rate increase during this forecast period, Powell told a virtual press conference on Wednesday, following a meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee, adding that the time to talk about reducing the central bank's asset purchases was, quote, not yet. But 7 of the 18 officials predicted higher rates by the end of 2023, compared with 5 of 17 at the December gathering, showing a slightly larger group who saw an earlier start than peers to the withdrawal of ultra-easy monetary policy, according to fresh quarterly Fed projections. Indicators of economic activity and employment have turned up recently, although the sectors most adversely affected by the pandemic remain weak, the FOMC said in its policy statement. Inflation continues to run below 2%. The Fed expects that a bump in inflation this year will be short-lived. Officials saw their preferred measure of price pressures slowing to 2% next year, followed by a spike to 2.4% in 2021, according to the projections. Excluding food and energy, inflation is forecast at 2.2% this year and fall to 2% in 2022. And the 10-year Treasury yield did wobble around a bit, but it continued to move higher. Asked about the recent move up in yields, Powell pushed back against the idea that the Fed should lean against the market, noting that the current stance of Fed policy, including its asset purchase program, was appropriate. Massive fiscal support and widening vaccinations that will help reopen the economy have buoyed investor expectations of rate increases and inflation, propelling Treasury yields higher as the central bank and federal government keep adding stimulus. The target range for the benchmark Fed funds rate was kept at 0 to 0.25%, where it's been since last March. And the decision, by the way, was unanimous. Now, the Federal Reserve continues to hold the course, maintaining the glide path of both rates and asset purchases, which it established last year. It does not appear to be close to altering its trajectory anytime soon. They left the asset purchases unchanged at $120 billion a month and repeated that that pace would be maintained until sustainable further progress is made on their employment and inflation goals. Powell told reporters that the Fed would signal well in advance when that threshold was on track to be achieved. Powell and his colleagues met as the economy continues to improve. Job gains picked up last month, and President Joe Biden signed an additional pandemic aid program into law on March the 11th. Vaccinations continue apace, allowing states to start easing lockdown restrictions, and that could release a torrent of consumer spending. The economy remains far from the Fed's goals, though. Even with 379,000 jobs added to payrolls in February, 9.5 million fewer Americans have jobs compared with a year ago, and inflation remains well below the Fed's 2% target. This particular downturn has a direct hit on the part of the economy that employs many minorities, Powell said. But Fed officials are growing more upbeat about the economy and jobs, and perhaps even further inflation. Still, the prospects for stronger growth have ignited some concerns about higher inflation. Contributing to a rise in 10-year Treasury yields in recent weeks, Powell told lawmakers in testimony last month the economy still has a long way to go before there's any risk of overheating. They also upgraded forecasts for economic growth and the labour market, with the median estimate for unemployment falling to 4.5% at the end of 2021 and 3.5% in 2023, while gross domestic product was seen to expand by 6.5% this year, up from a prior projection of 4.2%. Now, Westpac said that this March meeting communication, the FOMC continues to walk a fine line, showing fervent optimism in the recovery through 21 and 2022, while continuing to recognise that their economy is a long way from achieving maximum employment, let alone inflation sustainability. Hence, the US remains in need of ultra-accommodative financial conditions for an extended period. On the growth outlook, there was a substantial revision to 2021 GDP. The median year-end growth revised from 4.2% to 6.5% on the back of President Biden's $1.9 trillion stimulus package. This dramatic upward revision came without a material offsetting reduction in 2022 and 2023 growth, which both remain above trend at 3.3% and 2.2% respectively. Potential or long-term trend growth is seen at 1.8%. Now, if those outcomes eventuate, US GDP will be back above its pre-pandemic level by June 2021 and meaningfully ahead of where the economy would have been had it grown at trend through 2020-2022 by the end of next year. Now, that outturn is expected to see maximum employment achieved in late 2022 or 2023, with the unemployment rate at 3.9% in 2022 and 3.5% in 2023. The latter would be a pre-pandemic historic low for unemployment. Importantly, though, on the back of these outcomes, headline and core inflation are only seen marginally above the 2% per year medium target at the end of 2023, and core PCE inflation are only seen marginally above the 2% per year medium-term target at the end of 2023. It is not surprising, then, that the median policy expectation of the committee in December 2023 remains the lower bounds of 0.125%, with only 7 of 18 participants believing the Fed rate will be higher by then. And also in the press conference, Chairman Powell made very clear that the committee was not at a point when they would even begin to talking about tapering asset purchases, a signal that would come well in advance of the change in policies. These viewpoints highlight three key factors for the policy outlook. One, sustained rapid growth in the economy is necessary to heal the US post-pandemic and achieve maximum employment. Secondly, the optimism inherent in these forecasts notwithstanding, risks remain to the downside, particularly for inflation, which averaged only 1.6% per year over the decade before COVID-19 hit. And most importantly, three, this will see the FOMC remain reactive with policy, waiting to see their hopes for growth, the labour market and inflation become a reality before policy is tightened. But they also anticipate that the output gap will close by the end of 2022. And in fact, Westpac is more circumspect on the US prospect in 2023 and beyond, absent of an infrastructure and investment stimulus package later this year. So they believe the FOMC is right to wait to see if its expectations are achieved for acting on policy, both with respect to a taper and eventually rate increases. So they still expect the US 10-year yield will only trend towards 2.5% by the end of 2022, which is the FOMC's longer run estimate of the neutral Fed funds rate. And they went on to say that while the US looks set to outperform the global recovery in 2021, for our entire forecast period at the end of 2022, it is more likely to lag, particularly against Asia and emerging markets, where strong medium-term development prospects are clearly there. March's FOMC communications made clear the relative policy stance is very unlikely to prove an offset to the relative growth over the period, and so through late 21 and into 2022. Now, coming back to Australia, the February unemployment data from the ABS proved to be quite surprising, with a considerable rise, 89,000 in fact, full-time jobs, and part-time employment was also pretty good. With a flat participation rate of 66.1%, the unemployment rate fell to 5.8% from 6.3%. That was considerably lower than most economists were expecting. So unemployment is 0.6 percentage points higher than it was in March before the COVID lockdowns. And with unemployment up 3,600 on March, this higher rate of unemployment is explained by the 0.2 percentage point higher participation rate. And in fact, by gender, male participation was up 0.2%, while female participation was up 0.3%. Female unemployment rates therefore fell 0.7 percentage points to 5.5%, while male unemployment fell 0.4 percentage points to 6.1%. There was a strong recovery in hours worked, up 6.1% over the month, compared with the minus 4.9% collapse in January, for hours worked to now be up 0.2% in the year, and total employment is up 0.1% over the year to February. Now, as expected, New South Wales had a recovery from the January closures, up 42,000 jobs, with Victoria continuing the robust momentum from the reopening of its economy in late 2020, up 26,000 jobs. The hours worked increased across all states and territories except for Western Australia, where hours were affected by the lockdown in the first week of February. But there were some signs that in the more micro-level data, there are some issues at hand in the labour market as we head to the end of the JobKeeper programme. Underemployment lifted to 8.5% from 8.2%, which can't be explained by a rise in part-time employment due to the strong growth in full-time employment. Those working 0 hours for economic reasons, seasonally adjusted, lifted from 82,000 in January to 106,000 in February. But it would be dangerous to overstate those more micro risks, micro because they appear in distinct sectors and regions and occupations, for job losses given the strength of the overall recovery, Westpac said. And so far this year, there's been a distinct shift in employment towards full-time employment. Up into January, the majority of the recovery in employment was part-time. Since then, we have seen a market shift with full-time employment lifting 147,000 or 1.7% since December, while part-time employment is down 29,000 or down 0.7%. Since March, full-time employment is up 18,000 or 0.2%, while part-time employment is down 14,000 or 0.4%. Now, Bourne Jarvis, head of labour statistics at the ABS, said this latest data showed continued recovery in the labour market in February, particularly for women. The strong employment growth this month saw employment rise above 13 million people and was 4,000 people higher than March 2020. Full-time employment increased by 89,000 people, of which 69,000 were women. Female full-time employment was 1.8% higher than March 2020, while male full-time employment was 0.8% below. Seasonally adjusted hours worked bounced back in February, increasing by 6.1%, following the 4.9% fall in January, when more Australians than usual took leave. The youth unemployment rate declined by 1.1 percentage point to 12.9%, underpinned by a strong increase in the number of employed young women, up by 31,000 people. Underemployment increased by 0.4 percentage points to 8.5% in February, having fallen more than usual in January to remain around its pre-pandemic level. Now ahead, of course, we will have to see what happens with the removal of JobKeeper. We should expect to see job lists rise by at least 100,000, or perhaps substantially more, some are saying 250,000 to 300,000. Numbers vary across postcodes, but Melbourne, for example, shows a number of problem areas, especially in zones where mortgage stress remains high, areas around Wyndham to the west of Melbourne and Dandenong to the east are hotspots, according to the latest data available. And even in the west, south of Perth, there are a few hotspots, including places like Mandurah, or if you go north of Perth, in the high-growth corridors there. And in Tassie, while Hobart has low counts, there is a hotspot around Launceston, which again mirrors the mortgage stress hotspots. And according to the ABC, Tasmanian people aged 16 to 24 account for one-third of the public housing waitlist. In 2020, an average of 499 young Tasmanians accessed specialist homeless services on any given day. There are around 55 shelter beds in the state and 100 supported accommodation apartments, but the state government is planning to build more. The Youth, Family and Community Connections, the YFCC organisation in Davenport, is trying to assist. YFCC Chief Executive Ross Akinson said young Tasmanians cannot afford the market price when relying on the youth allowance, which is around $460 a fortnight. Rental prices have increased quite exponentially here in northwest Tasmania. It's becoming too difficult and too hard for people to access the available accommodation, she said. Youth allowance is quite low. There are minimal increases to the youth allowances, and it just will not meet the rental costs currently. Ross Atkinson from Youth, Family and Community Connections in Davenport says rental prices have increased exponentially in the northwest. Her organisation provides crisis accommodation in Burnie and Davenport, which Ms. Atkinson said is nearly always at capacity, with a four-week wait just to see a caseworker. If I could wave a magic wand, it would be to build more affordable homes. And ideally, I think it'd be great if a percentage of homes could be set aside for young people to access, she said. Tasmania has three supported accommodation facilities with a total of 100 self-contained apartments for young people aged 16 to 25 who are homeless or on low incomes. As well as Evelyn House in Devonport, there's Trinity Hill in Hobart and Tyne House in Launceston. But Tanya Hunt from the Youth Network of Tasmania said the facilities have strict selection criteria. We have many young Tasmanians that may not be eligible for these types of supported accommodations facilities. We have young Tasmanians experiencing complex needs. According to the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, one in four Tasmanians accessing specialist homelessness services in 2020 were young people. On any given day, 499 young people aged 16 to 24 sought support alone. Across the state, there were eight shelters available for young people, with a total of 55 beds. Ms. Hunt said it just was not enough. Now, back on JobKeeper, the SMH says one-fifth of JobKeeper payments made to major listed companies in the second half of 2020 went to firms who grew their profits during the pandemic, sparking fresh concerns that the $83 billion scheme has been abused by parts of corporate Australia. Fresh analysis from corporate governance advisory firm Ownership Matters has shown 66 of the ASX top 300 companies claimed a total of $1.3 billion in JobKeeper payments for the 6 months to the end of December. Of those, 58 reported positive profit figures during the period, and about half, 34 companies, told investors their underlying earnings had improved compared to pre-pandemic levels. These companies remained eligible for a total of $284 million handed out through the JobKeeper program. Ownership Matters said the figures showed many of the companies who received JobKeeper may not have actually needed the subsidy. Some shareholders have been hit in the bum by a JobKeeper rainbow. 90% of companies that got the subsidy were making money, but it's staggering that 50% of those who pocketed $284 million for the half were making more money than they were in 2019. Major companies have been under increasing pressure in recent months to repay JobKeeper stipends if their profits grew over the first half of 2021, with critics saying the program's intention was not to bolster corporate bottom lines or executive bonuses. A number of companies have pledged to return JobKeeper funds, with Super Retail Group, Cochlear, Acula, Collins Foods, Nine Entertainment and Domino's all contributing to the $100 million committed to be repaid among the ASX 300 entities. However, a number of major recipients have snubbed calls to repay the amount they claimed under the scheme, despite JobKeeper contributing significantly to their profits. Car dealership Eagers Automotive was one, with the company reporting $156 million in profits off the back of $130 million in JobKeeper payments. Retailer Harvey Norman has also said it won't repay JobKeeper, arguing instead it would effectively pay back the subsidy by paying higher taxes on its profits. For the 28 companies that told investors their businesses had improved over the pandemic, JobKeeper payments accounted for just 20% of their gains in underlying earnings. The group that are trading better than they were in 2019 got roughly 20% of all of the JobKeeper that went to ASX 300 companies over the half. Ownership Matters highlighted casino operators Star and Crown, along with G8 Education and Southern Cross Radio, as companies where JobKeeper payments made the greatest impact on their underlying earnings, as these entities were significant beneficiaries of government subsidies in periods when they reported positive earnings metrics. Investors should closely scrutinise the sustainability of earnings in future periods, as government assistance is being rolled back, said Ownership Matters. Now, Labour MP Andrew Leigh, who has been a major critic of JobKeeper, said the findings of the study suggested billions of dollars may have been wasted on firms that did not need support. If the Morrison government had been more careful in designing the program, it wouldn't have to have been cut off at the end of March, potentially making 250,000 people jobless, he said. But Treasurer Josh Frydenberg has consistently defended JobKeeper, saying it helped save hundreds of thousands of jobs across the economy. JobKeeper has helped save jobs. That is what it was intended to do, he said earlier this month. Now, the Australian scheme contrasts to the UK furlough scheme, where companies were only paid for staff that could not work. Many companies benefit by up to the $19,500 per worker, and their staff continue to work productively once restrictions were lifted. JobKeeper was designed for Armageddon, and when that didn't transpire, the government was obliged to keep paying. It's very clear now that there was a significant benefit to many shareholders. And more transparency from government would be welcome, especially given the lack of oversight over 97% of the program's claimants. And of course, the bottom line is this: the money went to big firms who didn't need it. It didn't get to small firms who did need it. And those small firms are at risk now of falling over. Now, over in the West, according to MPA, the West Australian government must step up on housing issues, says the peak body over there. The newly elected McGowan government and the Western Australian Labor Party need to prioritise addressing the housing issues facing the state. According to the top WA housing industry body, Damien Collins, president of the Real Estate Institute of Western Australia, said he was disappointed that the McGowan government did not prioritise the housing market during the 2021 election campaign. WA is facing housing supply issues in the sales and rental sectors simultaneously, and these problems will only worsen without long-term policy initiatives to address barriers to entering the housing market, Collins said. While the building grants during the pandemic did help create additional supply, we're disappointed that there were no commitments other than a limited amount of additional public housing from the WA Labor Party to help tackle those problems, particularly given the state's enviable budget surplus position. So Collins called for bold reform to increase access to housing, especially in addressing the rental shortage and luring investors back into the market. REIWA also renewed its call for stamp duty reform. Stamp duty is a key area of concern for WA buyers, and there is clear desire for this ineffective tax to be reformed. Collins said other states like New South Wales are taking these steps, so there's no reason why WA shouldn't also be looking at alternative methods of revenue collection to help ease the financial burden on buyers and make housing more affordable. In an REIWA survey of more than 1,000 Western Australians, 90% of respondents said stamp duty was a significant barrier to home ownership, and 60% said they would opt for an ongoing annual payment if given the choice. REIWA has called upon all political parties to commit to 5 policy recommendations, including supporting stamp duty reform, developing a plan to address WA's rental shortage, creating jobs by removing stamp duty on the purchase of a small business, boosting the retail sector through a legislative framework that encourages innovation, and formalising the off-the-plan stamp duty rebate to secure ongoing construction jobs and limit urban sprawl. It's not too late, they said, for the WA government to prioritise the housing market and put policies in place that help address the growing supply issues facing our state. We hope to work closely with the McGowan government in the coming years to tackle these issues so we can help achieve a fair and prosperous property market for all West Australians. To which I reply, supply is not the answer. Supply is definitely not the answer, and yet, of course, that is where the industry goes to every time. Now, over in New Zealand, the government there has drawn flak for using KiwiBuild funds to settle land disputes, according to NZ Advisor. The government has drawn flak from ignoring the Treasury's warning against using KiwiBuild funds to purchase disputed land at Ituatoa. According to NewsHub, the government used a workaround to build the disputed land from Fletcher's for $30 million despite the Treasury's warning, taking cash from the KiwiBuild program Land for Housing. The Treasury warned, if Cabinet wants the Crown to purchase the land at Itatua, we do not recommend doing so through the Land for Housing program. New Zealand Taxpayers Union spokesman Louis Holbrook slammed the government for using taxpayer money meant for building houses to block houses instead. It appears that the government has spent KiwiBuild funds outside of the scope for which Parliament approved it. Aside from being undemocratic, this spending opens the government to the risk of a costly legal challenge, they said. The result of the government's deal is fewer houses in the area built more slowly, and the land purchases also incentivised protesters across New Zealand to use occupations as a tactic to block new housing. We're really seeing it at Shelley Bay and Opua, he continued. It's little wonder house prices keep leaping up when politicians are actively intervening with taxpayer money to make things worse. Now, it's bad enough, they said, that KiwiBuild has failed, but it's even worse if ministers are now treating it as a slush fund for their BEP projects, said National's finance spokesman Michael Woodhouse. The Land for Housing program was set up with the explicit purpose to rapidly provide new housing. Funding in the program was included in budget appropriations voted for by Parliament, and Treasury documents described it as being intended to facilitate the development of KiwiBuild affordable homes. National's housing spokesman Nicola Willis said the government's actions put an existing housing development at risk, adding that it still has not said when and how many homes were built in the area. Taxpayers aren't a bank to be called on to clean up the government's poor decisions, particularly when it's meddling in private property rights, Willis said. More than 20,000 Kiwi families are on the waiting list for a home right now. The government shouldn't be spending $30 million on stopping 480 much-needed houses from being built. And finally, back in Australia, Westpac has announced that it will sell its lenders' mortgage insurance business to a global specialist insurer. In a statement, Westpac said it would sell Westpac Lenders Mortgage Insurance Limited to Arch Capital and enter into a 10-year exclusive supply agreement to provide lenders' mortgage insurance to the group. The bank said the sale price would be at book value and would be confirmed at completion. However, Westpac would record a loss on the sale in the 21 financial year as a result of the separation and transaction costs. Westpac is pleased to be entering into a long-term partnership with Arch, as LMI is an important product and helps the group make home ownership more accessible for more Australians, the bank's chief executive of specialist businesses and group strategy, Jason Yetton, said. The sale continues the simplification of our business and builds on our progress in becoming a simpler, stronger bank focused on consumer, business and institutional banking. And Westpac said that it would retain responsibility for certain legacy matters in the transaction, which was due to occur at the end of August. Now, just a couple of interesting observations there. The LMI sector is going through quite a significant disruption at the moment, what with Genworth essentially selling part of its business, and now Westpac selling theirs. We wonder whether there's more to it than perhaps meets the eye with regard to the number of defaults that might be lurking in the shadows. It'll be very interesting to see whether, in fact, the claims from lenders and mortgage insurers rise over the next year or two. We think that's quite possible, given the end of JobKeeper and everything else that we're seeing. But that said, the better jobs news today might actually give us more encouragement about the trajectory of the local economy. Although I think the big question with regard to the US and the rates that we discussed earlier suggests to me that we may well see rates rising sooner than many expect. And whether that leads to inflation, well, that's a whole new discussion which we'll have on another day. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.